Hi everyone, I'm Justin Chisholm, welcoming you to another episode of the Yacht Racing Podcast. My guest this time is British America's Cup sailor and Olympic gold medalist rower, Matt Gottrell, who has just re-signed as a member of the powerhouse grinding team for the British Challenger of Record at AC37, Ben Ainslie's Ineos Britannia. As you'll hear in the interview, Matt comes from a sailing family and began his career crewing in dinghies on lakes in the south of England. He quickly progressed through the 29er class and into the 49er to join the British Olympic sailing team before putting his sailing on hold to go to university. That's where he was lured into the world of competitive rowing, a sport in which he worked his way up to Olympic selection and went on to win the gold in the men's eight at the Rio 2016 Olympic Games. But he wasn't done with sailing yet, and he joined Ineos Britannia for the British Syndicate's 36th America's Cup campaign, and now he's back for another try at winning sailing's oldest and most prestigious trophy. Matt Gottrell, welcome to the Yacht Racing Podcast. And first of all, congratulations on the news that you've re-signed with Ineos Britannia for a second tilt at trying to bring the America's Cup back to the UK. Does it feel good to be back in harness?
Yeah, definitely. No, thanks for having me, firstly. But it's great to be back involved with the team. Obviously, there was a bit of unfinished business where we left in New Zealand. So there's been a lot of work going on between now and then behind the scenes. Obviously, the Challenger Record is now a slightly new look for the team and moving forward. So, yeah, it's very exciting. Great to be back and part of the team again. So, yeah, looking forward to it.
Now, I always like to find out from my guests how they were introduced to sailing in the first place. You've kind of got two sports, so we're going to have to do this twice. But let's start with sailing before we move on to the rowing. Can you take us back to when you first sailed?
Yeah. I mean, sailing's kind of in the family for me, like most people. So I started when I was about eight, I think, with my dad in the lakes around near me in the Cotswolds. My grandfather also sailed, so it was kind of I was dragged along to sailing lakes around the country from quite an early age, and I loved it from day one, and then followed it through kind of the youth system, and I was always a crew though, because I was a bit big. I had an oppie for a little bit, but I think a few capsizes and I was straight out of that. So I did a lot of crewing from the early age, and then went to 29ers, 49ers, and then into the Olympic program for a short stint.
So name check the sailing clubs that were involved back then.
So Bowmore Sailing Club was probably one of my first clubs, and I spent most of my time at Draycott Water. Was where I spent lots of hours spent around there. So and we had like three generations at the club as well. So it was very nice for that, to be able to go and see my grandpa every weekend and go racing against my dad. And I remember pursuit races as well, where they would all be on the course at the same time. So it was always a bit of a family rivalry going on.
So other than the Optimus, what other boats, what other classes were you sailing back then?
So I crewed an RS200 when I was a bit younger, lightweight specialist crew in that one. And then I started sailing RS800s because my dad was doing the national circuit. I think it was a good excuse for him to, if he could take his son along, he'd get a bit more time away. So I ended up crewing for another guy from the club. So I was crewing 800s at the age of 14, and then moved into 29ers from that. Did a couple of years in the 29er youth system, and then moved into 49ers once I'd kind of graduated from that, I guess.
And any other siblings around to compete for the sailing spots?
I had a younger brother, he's 6 years younger than me, so it was quite a big gap, and he came sailing a few times but never really took to it, so it was definitely a thing that my dad and I were into.
And what about other sports? I always like to find out whether sailing was the passion and no other sport got a look in, which is was the case with me. But quite a lot of people, they played other stuff as well, very competitively.
Yeah, I mean, at school I was into everything, football, cricket, rugby, everything under the sun. But there came a point where sailing took over. So your weekends were always taken up travelling around and racing. But then after I decided to go to university, did 18 months or 2 years in the British team, the 49ers. It was a very strong time for 49ers back then. It was just after Beijing. I think we had 6 boats in the top 10 in the world in world ranking. So, and we were definitely in the bottom of the list. So just the newbies trying to get into the team. So I thought I'd go and get a degree at Loughborough, and to keep fit, I thought I'd take up rowing. And yeah, so I kind of got into that at university at the age of, I was just about to turn 21 when I started. So I was very new to that. But again, I loved the being on water and being outside, and took to that pretty quickly, and very fortunate to have a career, I'd say, in rowing as well.
Well, we'll get to that in a second. Let's just go back to the 29ers and the 49ers. You were part of the British sailing team then, and as you say, that was, my God, we had such a hot 49er squad back then. It was harder to win a berth than it was to win a medal, I think, wasn't it, at that point?
It was pretty impressive. I remember just when you go down, based in Weymouth, and you just go out for a training day, and you realise the amount of world championships and European championships and medalists at international level that were just going out and racing every day. So yeah, the racing was intense, and it kind of goes to show that how well we represented on the international stage by just how hard the training was in the UK, because we turn up to events and you'd almost guarantee if one person didn't win that someone else would, so they'd always be pushing each other on. So it was a very good time for 49er sailing. At the time, it still is now, but I guess it's always a part of the Olympics, and only one boat gets to go, so it's pretty tough out there for a lot of people who are trying to break that into that team and get a spot in the Olympics.
And who were you sailing with back with then? Were you helming or crewing?
I was crewing for a guy called Chris Rashley. He's done a lot in the foiling world and a lot of coaching since then. But I was in the same generation coming out of 29ers as the likes of Dylan Fletcher. So we were quite good mates and did a lot of sailing together back then. And there was a lot of people around, and Stevie and Ben were obviously the guys who went to the games. But you had Chris Draper, Simon Hiscox in separate boats then. So they were there. Lots of the old guys who had been at it for a while, and they were very good sailors. So yeah, no, it was a great time. Great to be part of the squad. I think if I'd go back now, I'd probably approach it a bit differently. It's a little bit wet behind the ears at 18, 19 years old, but it was an amazing experience.
So you made the decision to park the sailing for a bit, stick a pin in it, go to university. That probably pleased your parents, I would imagine, did it?
A little bit, yeah. I mean, it was a bit last minute. I actually managed to get a place at university whilst I was at a sailing event. So I did it through clearing, all a bit last minute. I was at the Europeans in Croatia, and Chris had decided that he was going to do something else, and I was kind of left a little bit in the lurch. But I kind of thought, I'd always had an idea to go to university. So I think this was in about August that I started applying and ended up going to university I'd never been to before, just the only place I got offered and accepted. So I ended up at Loughborough.
And you were doing engineering then. So what sort of engineering?
Systems engineering was the course. So it's kind of a lot of everything, but a kind of a very systemic approach to engineering, looking at how businesses and systems work as a whole, and then obviously the specifics of electronics and things like that. But for me, I liked to almost got a degree in rowing more than I did in engineering. The amount of time was spent in the lecture room compared to on the water was probably not quite even.
So how quickly did that change come from, professional Olympic campaigner in 49ers to going to university to then suddenly taking the rowing super seriously? Had you rowed before you went to university?
Slightly. I was offered to start doing some rowing with a friend at school when I was about 16, and his dad was coaching him and pushing quite heavily for me to get involved. Little did I know at the time that his dad was an Olympic silver medalist and coached one of the British sculls, but I kind of thought, oh no, I'll stick to sailing, thanks. Can't be dealing with the early mornings. And then I went to university and I just enjoyed the whole camaraderie of it, the team element, and kind of just the discipline required to just get up and do as you're told and do your training program for the day. And I think that's kind of what I kind of took to quite quickly. And it was quite good because obviously you have a big group of you, so you don't feel like you're missing out on any of the social time that you would do some rowing later when you're not at uni. So we still had good time and there was a good group of lads there to get stuck in with.
Did they approach you or did you approach them? I'm guessing with your physique, they probably looked at you as a bit of a target, really.
Yeah, I had the interest of getting into it because I'd always been told through fitness testing with the sailing team that if I'd ever turn my hand to rowing, I'll probably be quite good on a rowing machine. So I went in to the first week of uni thinking maybe I'll give it a go, but I walked into the hall with all the sports in, and there was quickly a 6'8" guy next to me with his arm around me saying, I think you should come rowing. So I didn't have much choice at that point.
What are you, how tall are you, and what did you weigh back then?
I'm 6'5". Coming out of 49ers, I was probably just under 90 kilos. So I was skin and bone, really. Rowing kind of, I was always quite light as a rower. The height definitely helps.
And yeah, so I guess tall, long levers, that's perfect for rowing or swimming, I think, isn't it?
Yeah. And I had the luxury of, my dad was a very keen cyclist as well in the 80s, and I was forced to cycle to school from the age of about 4 every day. So I had a fairly decent base level of fitness to turn my hand at. I was always ready to be fit. But I think, he takes a bit of credit for that now. But yeah, there was plenty of hours spent on the bike when I was younger.
Since the age of 4?
Yeah.
Wow. No, not on your own when you were 4, though, no?
Oh, he would cycle with me. We had various combinations of him running, the dog as well, my little brother, we had a tandem, there was all sorts. But yeah, it was 4 miles each way. So it's not much, but it all adds up. And you did that until and then if I wanted to do any sports after school or go see friends, I'd have to cycle there. So I was always pretty active.
Now, you said you were pretty light coming out of sailing, and skin and bone is what you is what you said. Does that mean you weren't fit, or you were fit? Because I've always viewed the British sailing team sailors as being some of the fittest in the world. In fact, all the national sailing team.
Sailors. Definitely. I wasn't fit specifically for anything else other than kind of 49er sailing at the time. But I was always quite lean anyway. As a kid, I always struggled to put weight on, and I was actually the right weight for as a 49er crew at the time. So it was perfect for that. Wasn't that something I'd ever really thought about. It was, but then obviously with the rowing, kind of expectation is that most people are 95 kilos and you're my sort of size. So yeah, but it took me about 4 years to start put some decent weight on.
Right. So you went from 49er crew weight to Ben Ainslie fin sailing weight.
Yeah, something like that. Yeah.
I'm not sure he ever made 95 kilos, but maybe 92 or something.
Probably did at some point. You won't tell you that.
So what was the switch over from sailing to rowing? Did you go into that and think, oh my God, like I need to step the fitness up massively for this? Or was it just different? You just needed to be different physically?
It was just a hobby, really. I enjoyed keeping fit. I loved pushing myself. So I didn't really know where it was going to take me. But at the time, I just kind of got sucked into what was going on around me with the other guys that were training. So you kind of got into that routine of going to train together. You'd sit next to each other on a rowing machine and you'd try and knock 2 bows out of each other and who could do the best score. And that's kind of how it started. And the first year as a uni was probably one of the best fun I had, because there was no expectations and it was just good fun, really. And then after that, it started getting a bit more serious in terms of there was things that I could aim for, which I didn't really, was never on my radar when I started. I didn't start rowing with the idea to kind of get in the British rowing team, or even, I hadn't even joined another club. I was just rowing at university.
And at that point, had you mentally come to terms with the idea of, right, Olympics dream is done now? If it was going to happen, it would have happened through sailing.
Not necessarily. I mean, I'd always had the conversation with, I think Barry Edgerton was the development manager at the time, and he said, look, go to uni, keep busy, keep fit, try and do a bit of sailing, and we'll see what happens when you finish. Because plenty of people have kind of done that, gone to uni, come back. And so I hadn't shut the door on sailing at all. But then obviously there's only so many hours in the day. And once the rowing kind of started, I was like, well, I'll throw myself at this, at least whilst I'm at uni, and then I'll see what opportunities come later down the line.
I don't know too much about rowing, but when you started off, were you rowing in kind of small teams or big teams?
I spent my first year rowing in an 8, just because we're lucky enough to have like a fast track group where one of the other students had taken it upon himself to create kind of he did a testing week where everyone came in and he handpicked kind of a few guys that he thought could be kind of really good transferable skills from other sports, like rugby players. We had athletes from track, and then I came from sailing, obviously. But there was potential for them to actually go somewhere in the sport. And he was a student at the time, so he was quite lucky that that was going on. So we had 10 guys training every day, trying to get into an eight. So it was quite competitive, but it was also quite a small group. So I was always quite good on the rowing machine itself, but then obviously the technical side of rowing is bigger than people think. You can't just sit there and ergos don't float is the classic rowing term that we hear quite a lot. But yeah, no.
Right.
But we were, yeah, I mean, the first year was mainly in eights. And then after that, I got applied for one of these talent ID schemes, which UK Sport run. So it was tall and talented. and they basically give you, if you get in, they provide you with a coach and a boat and a full-time program, basically. And it's seen as like a pathway into the senior teams and the kind of the European university teams and that sort of thing. So just to get work your way up the ladder and try and find that kind of diamond in the rough, I guess, is what they're looking for.
Yeah.
I didn't hit the strength scores on it. I was fit enough, but I wasn't strong enough. But thankfully in Nottingham, they didn't have enough spaces, and it was our local satellite centre from Loughborough. So they decided to take me on. So I kind of squeezed in the door, not quite having the right scores, but so that started in my second year. And after that, it just became basically a full-time program. And I also joined Nottingham Rowing Club with the men's team there. And that's when I got to row with other people outside of university and learn from them. And it was a very good time. And I just did that for a couple of years with obviously the Bucks University Championships and things like that, were our like main points of the year. And in my last year of uni, I tried to go to the British trials to try and get into a kind of development team. And I've been injured all year, so I kind of didn't think there was much hope. Went up to the trial, got paired with someone I never rode with before, just like a couple of weeks before. And it all kind of comes down to one race, and then right. They decide what to do after that. So final trials is a big thing in British rowing. I kind of came second from last, I think, in that. But they decided to invite everyone back for a thing called seat racing, where they just put fours out, mix everyone around, and then they'll swap one person at a time and try and see who can get the best combinations. And once that started, I somehow managed to find kind of my niche, and I did quite well in that and ended up going to the Europeans. So I finished university in 2012, graduated, and then I was straight into the Europeans development team, which would have been a normal senior team, but the Olympics were going on obviously in 2012, so they just wanted to take some guys who might be kind of knocking on the door. So I kind of gone from being injured in the January to then being training at the GB Centre and potentially being around for the next Olympiad. And I remember after London, the performance director came to me and said, "Do you think you're ready to join the senior team?" And this was all in the space of about 4 months, really. And wow. I said, "Don't think so." I knew I wasn't big enough or strong enough compared to some of the guys that you know what their ergo scores are, you know what they do in the gym. And I didn't think I was anywhere near that standard. And he said, "Well, there's one way to find out." And so then I went straight from uni, straight into the British senior team and down in Caversham. And yeah, that was pretty amazing, really. So didn't have a chance to kind of stop and think. But before I knew it, I was then into a full-time training program. Had Jürgen Grobler as my coach. I was sharing changing rooms with Olympic champions. That was pretty amazing.
But also, you finished university, because earlier on in the interview, I thought you kind of gave me the hint that you spent more time on the water and maybe it didn't work out. But you came away with a degree.
I came away with a degree, which was good. Touch and go for a while, but it just coincides with the rowing season as well, when your trials, and suddenly you get a phone call on a Monday being like, "Can you come down to Caversham, which is where the British team's based, to train for a week?" And you can't really say no. So it was, I remember having a discussion with my supervisor for my dissertation. And she said, "Oh, what are you going to do when you finish that?" "Might be thinking about going rowing." She was like, "Yeah, but what are you going to do as a job?" I said, "I know, I'm thinking about going rowing full time." She's like, "Yeah, no, but what about your degree?" So I worry about that later, but at the moment, rowing is kind of where I'm heading. And she was a bit surprised, but I didn't know it was really a thing. And yeah, kind of once I got into the team, it was then just about kind of getting my head down and doing what I was told, really. And it came to fruition eventually.
Now tell me, on a rowing eight, there must be individual roles on the boat. As I say, I know nothing about rowing, so my apologies. But can you kind of break that down for us?
Yeah.
Not everybody's doing the same job, are they?
No, not exactly. But I mean, a lot of it is everyone doing the same thing at the same time is essentially what you're trying to get down to. But there are slightly different roles in the boat. The guys in the stern, the stroke man, who everyone sits behind, he's kind of sets the rhythm for everyone. So you kind of want someone who's very consistent, sometimes a bit stubborn. So they're just going to do their own thing and everyone else has to follow. And the person behind them has to then link him to the rest of the boat. So that's quite an important role. The middle four guys are generally your engine room. So they're your heavier, stronger guys. And then your two guys in the bows are more technical. It's probably lighter. Generally how it goes. But obviously you get so many different, there's so many moving parts in an eight. And that's the skill of the coach to put the right people in the right seats. And that's where you get the best results.
I got all of that except the two guys at the front. More technical in what way?
Because there's so much momentum moving in the boat. The bows move up and down quite a lot. So in order to have the timing right, you've got to be very accurate with how your blade work and things like that. And it can move around a bit more. You have to be a little bit smaller anyway just to fit in.
Right. And where were you in the? Where were you on the boat?
I was most of the time. I was sat in the middle. Even though being one of the lighter guys, I was quite good on the rowing machine, so I could kind of fill a few roles. I won a world champs in the middle of the boat. I won a world champs in the bow seat. And then in Rio, I ended up in the middle again. Everyone can row in every seat. But essentially, it's up to the coach to move. We moved around so many times in the Olympic year. Not always with great effect, but it's good to learn. It's good to see another different position in the boat.
You've been in both camps now. Is a rowing team in terms of the kind of atmosphere and I want to say camaraderie, is it the same as a sailing team? Very similar or different?
It's a little bit different. I think the thing with rowing is for half the year you're competing against each other, trying to get that spot in the boat. And once you get to your final trials and once the boats are selected, after that point, then you're all teammates and you've then got to then you become very close. Off the sailing teams, everyone has their roles and you're always part of a team from day one. And no one really directly doing your job elsewhere on the boat. So there's less of that kind of rivalry within the team. And the teams tend to be a bit bigger, I guess. So there's so many different moving parts and everyone's kind of got their own role in the sailing world. But at the end of the day, once you get on a race course, it's very similar. You've all got your jobs to do and you've got to do it to 100%. Otherwise, you're not going to get around the course and you're not going to get the result you want. So that was my biggest thing that I've learned from sport, and the biggest thing that drives me and people always ask me is I hate letting people down. So I'd do whatever I can just to do my job to the best of my ability. And I don't really think about the personal side of it. It's just about doing the best for the team.
That's a good answer. And another dumb rowing question: the boats are all identical, or you can have some technology put into the boats?
I mean, compared to the sailing world, they're fairly Jurassic, really. I mean, very little is done in terms of hull finish. And there are kind of three main manufacturers across the world, in one in Germany, one in Italy, and a couple in America that people use. But I mean, they're very simple, really. There's not much technology going on there, unfortunately. It's just down to the training you do off the water and on the water, obviously. But the training you do in the background seems to have a much more impact, which I think maybe they're missing a trick there.
Yeah, could be an opportunity. So I have to ask the question, rowing and sailing, which is more fun?
Sailing is more fun. depends what your class is fun, but type two fun is when you're sat there, you can taste your lungs in your mouth, and that's the rowing tour fun, which we do get slightly in the grinding roles in the boat, but sailing is definitely, there's so much more to it without kind of playing down the rowing a little bit, but it's a great sport to be back involved in.
Now, my view of training for rowing is kind of coloured by Steve Redgrave's, Sir Steve Redgrave's comment of, if you ever see me in a boat again, shoot me, I think it was, because he just didn't want to live that lifestyle anymore. Can you talk about what those, did you have those kind of grueling long days of super early starts? And
I did have long days, and the days where you feel like you can't walk up the stairs and you're on your hands and knees crawling around the house and you just have to sleep. And that was kind of how you lived your life. You put your life on hold so you can train. So you train in the morning, you eat, you train afterwards, you eat, you have a nap, you train again, you come home, you eat and you sleep, and you do that for 4 years. I luckily did it for 4 years. But you think of the likes of Steve Redgrave, 5 Olympics, it's, you can see why he'd say something like that. So I was very fortunate to get into the sport, achieve what I wanted to, and I made the decision to step away. Because of that, really, you do have to put your life on hold. And I'd always wanted to go to the Olympics when I was sailing as well. It was always a passion when I was younger. So to be able to do it and to win was pretty mad. So I kind of took the opportunity then to realize that there was more to life than Olympic sport, unfortunately. And it's not a career, you can't do it forever. It is, the days are long and grueling, but you're doing it because you're doing it with all your mates, and there's a group of you doing it. If you don't turn up, someone else will. And that was the culture that was there at British Rowing. It was a great team to be a part of.
So let's talk about that gold medal win. We've buried it 25 minutes into the chat, and we've buried it all the way till now. So tell us about that. Did you go in, because you were an eight team at that point, did you go in as favourites or medal hopefuls?
We kind of, if you started halfway through the year, a lot of people would have said we were favourites. I mean, GB had won every world champs since London. But with very different people in the boats, who kind of move them around. Sometimes it'd be the top boat, sometimes it'd be the second boat. So you'd, depending on the athletes and the qualification and things. But at the start of that season, we were definitely the favourites. We didn't win a race all year. So we'd lost to everyone at some point who was going to the Olympics. So in that sense, you could have said you could have easily come last or first. It was, but we knew we were a very good team. We had a great combination of experience. I was sat between two double Olympic champions. And then we had guys who had won worlds. We had guys who had a bronze and a silver medal and were searching for that gold. So there was three of us who it was our first games as well. So it was quite a good mix. The moment that kind of changed it for us was that we had our last race before we went to our training camps and pre-Olympic camps. We got beaten by the Germans by 6 seconds, I think, in the heat World Cup. And then we came back and had a proper race with them in the final. But we didn't have we had a better row, but we had changed a few things. And we basically just took it right back to basics and just took it. We had a saying that said, take it one stroke at a time. And we ended up going down the course, the equivalent of kind of like half throttle, really. We were doing 30 strokes a minute and the Germans were doing 38 type thing. But we lost them by half a length. But that kind of gave us the confidence as we went away. We said, if we can do this and turn it into a race piece, then we know we'll be untouchable. And we turned up in the heat against the Dutch and we were leading by 3 seconds at halfway. We knew at that point that at the start of the week that it would take a lot to beat us. And it proved out to be that way. And it was probably one of the most dominant Olympic finals, especially the British boats, ever had. And one of the easiest races in terms of that I've been involved in. So it was a bit bizarre, really.
Can you remember the feeling when you realised you'd won a gold medal?
There's a fair amount of relief, I think, is the biggest feeling. A lot of pressure, a lot of expectation as well when you've got kind of the history of British rowing. And we had a very good group of guys, a lot of guys we knew it was their last Olympics. And yeah, it was fantastic. It was, it was just a great, just great experience by the end of it, and to be there under Christ Redeemer with friends and family. That was, an amazing thing.
So Matt, what happened, after that, that gold medal win in the rowing? You then, I guess, decided you probably weren't going to go on with the rowing. You have to find something else to do? Did you consider getting a proper job, or did it immediately turn to America's Cup?
I did a trial with BAR in 2015 with the intention of potentially, well, I would love to have gone to Bermuda in 2017, but obviously at the time I was so focused on my rowing that I wasn't really directly transferable into the grinding, but in hindsight it would have been a great opportunity. So I kind of thought that wasn't going to be an option. After Rio, I didn't really know what I wanted to do. There was a great kind of 3-4 months where obviously dust is settling on what was going on, and the celebrations back in the UK, and that was an amazing time. And I, like a lot of athletes, didn't really know what to do. So I went back to training for a little bit and decided I just didn't have the motivation for it at that time. So they kindly gave me a year off to decide what I wanted to do. In which time I did things I hadn't done for a long time. I went skiing and had sort of caught up with mates in London and all around the country, and just, yeah, had probably a few too many drinks that I was making up for over the previous years. But I then decided that I'd probably try and follow my degree and see what would happen in that world. So I was fortunate enough to get a job at Rolls-Royce in Birmingham as part of the control systems team, working on the kind of the aerospace industry. And yeah, I mean, it was a great opportunity, great job, very different to the rowing world. And it's a challenge that a lot of athletes face, transferring back into the real world and realizing what they A, have to offer, and B, what they can get out of it that can fill that little void that they've been so used to. So I did that for a year, and I was enjoying it. I missed sport. I missed that element of kind of being able to apply what I knew. I feel like everything I was learning was new, and I wasn't actually offering anything that I'd learned over the last 6-7 years. Well, since I was a kid, really. And it was then that I got a phone call from Chris Draper and Dylan Fletcher about talking about the start of SailGP and whether I was interested in coming back and doing some grinding. And it was a bit of a no-brainer for me, really. I'd been missing that. And it was a door back into sailing, which I didn't think I was ever going to get the opportunity to again. So, I jumped to that opportunity and haven't really looked back since.
So where did the hookup with Sir Ben come?
In the first season of SailGP, I spent a bit of time training and sailing with some of the other grinders that Ben had on his team, Neil Hunter being one and Nick Hutton. So I spent a season where they were doing the SailGP stuff as well. So they've kind of got to know me and realised that I had something to offer if they needed some kind of bit of help in training. So that was the first conversation we had, was that in the lead up to the last cup that I'd come in and give them a hand with training days, really, and just be another man to arm the pumps and try and get them through that. So I very much came in as kind of bottom of the team and just there to help out, which I was perfectly happy with. I know at that time I wasn't in a position where I wasn't particularly good at grinding in terms of the actual numbers that we needed, and it had taken me a long time to convert my legs from rowing into my arms, which is probably about 18 months by the time. And then, I loved, again, being back in that environment, training with guys day in, day out, and pushing yourself kind of gets the best out of me. And it was the same in that case. And it was great to be a part of that team of grinders as well.
The boats must have been a bit of a surprise to you. The F50s must have been a bit of a culture shock from the 49er that you last sailed.
Yeah, the sport had changed somewhat in the 10 years I was away. Even though I was sailing with guys that I think in that first year, everyone had come from a sailed a 49er at some point, and we'd sailed against each other. So that was quite nice. But yeah, no, from the outside, they do look like big beasts, and they are. But when you're on, they do feel like big dinghies. When you're sailing these boats, they're still very twitchy. They're still very sensitive to weight, and although there's more moving parts, and obviously my role as a grinder is a bit different to how I was in the 49er, but you still feel like you're attached to the boat, and especially in that role, you're attached to a wing sheet directly, so you feel like you're trimming essentially. But no, the boats are amazing. They are unbelievable bits of kit, and it does go to show how much the sport has changed over the last 10, 15 years now with foiling boats and the technology and the manpower involved in getting these boats on the water is amazing.
And I guess it would be quite terrifying if you were a rower who hadn't ever done anything high performance in sailing wise. It would be a really big culture shock.
Definitely. Also, I think it's hard having that understanding of like when to trim and understanding boat heel and just especially like, the biggest thing I did bring to it is I was used to facing backwards, so that was all right. I could deal with that part of it. So, but just understanding where you are on the race course and being preemptive as to what's going to happen next, even when you don't, no one's saying anything, you know what's coming, makes a huge difference. And I think I was very fortunate, obviously, to be in that position with having the rowing background, with the fitness and the discipline to training, and being able to apply myself in that side of things. But obviously, having the sailing knowledge as well was a huge asset.
And you sail both boats now, the F50s for SailGP and the AC75s with the America's Cup. They're very different, monohulls and catamarans, obviously. Other than the obvious difference that you do more running around on the F50, what are the other differences for you in your role?
Big difference is that you're not directly driving any kind of sail as such. We tacked the jib in the America's Cup boat, but on the F50 you are directly attached to the wing sheet and you only grind on demand for that, whereas in the Cup you are pumping oil 90% of the time. So it's a very different sort of role. It's a head down time trial sort of race, whereas the F50 is very much more up and down, stop and start. You feel more connected to the boat. It's a lot twitchier, like I said, more like a go-kart in comparison to the supercar, which is what the AC75 is.
Yeah, that I guess that does make sense. And that running from one side to the other on the tacks adds a whole new dimension to it, doesn't it?
It does. You realise that your happy place is inside a cockpit. As soon as you take a step out there, you know, things might start to change somewhat. But the G-forces on those boats, I think you feel them so much more than you do in a big boat, just because you're obviously the two hulls, and if you're on the outside of a turn, you do get that slingshot feeling. And bearaways and roundups, they do feel very different in the 50. It is way more exposed, and thankfully we're clipped on now with the boat, so you can kind of throw, when you're running across the boat, you can kind of commit a little bit more and not worry about what you're holding on to with your hands so much, and just concentrate on getting the boat across the boat as fast as possible. But it's something I look forward to. It's great to be a part of. Like, the excitement and the buzz every day that you push off the dock and go sailing is definitely still there.
Can I take you back to AC36? And obviously, you know, I remember I interviewed Ben after the pre-Christmas regatta, which was a huge disappointment for all the British fans and for you guys as sailors as well, I'm sure. There was that kind of Fortress Ineos mentality. You guys went into the Christmas break, put the shutters down and got on with sorting out the problem. Can you tell us anything about that?
I think it was clear for everyone and clear to the outside world as well that we had a problem. I think up until that point, you never really know until you get in a race situation with another boat. So even though we had our worries about certain elements, it was always that kind of to and fro between, well, the designers think that it's going to be all right and the same thing, but we're not too sure. And so until that point, there was never like that combined focal point for us to all get behind. And I think after that, it was just gave us that siege mentality that this is something we have to fix. And it was amazing to see the team come together and what we managed to achieve in that short piece of time. And there were some long, long days on the water, some even longer days in the shed for a lot of people. And to turn it around to where we got to was fairly remarkable in the space of time that we had. And it was a shame the way it kind of all kind of panned out in the end, but we definitely had some moments where we were definitely competitive for sure, and we had some great boat speed at times, and the boat came together well. So hopefully we've learned a lot from that and we can take that forward into AC37.
The best race of the Cup for my mind was one of the early races between Luna Rossa and Ineos. I'm guessing you must have been on board for that, were you?
I was on board for that one, yeah. I was I was on the port side, so I remember, I didn't look up very often, but I remember looking up and seeing that it's just a slightly tight cross coming here.
the downwind cross,
I
yeah.
I put my head down again and just grinded some more, so there was no excuse. I remember I was myself and Chris Brittle were next to each other, and I just remember thinking that we couldn't stop our handles turning for love nor money at that point. There was plenty of power going down, a bit of nervous energy kicking around. but it was, yeah, no, our race was amazing. And yeah, it just goes to show that these boats can be very, very evenly matched, which people were worried about, I guess, to start off with. So hopefully the next time round, we're going to see, just as much close racing like that.
Now, what's the milestones for you now with the team? You've just re-signed, but you gave me the kind of suggestion that you've been planning stuff with them for a little while now.
I mean, personally, not really. I mean, obviously, there's been a lot of mention of Cyclors over the past few months and stuff. So that's obviously been a focus, just to make sure we're kind of get the ball rolling with that, which for me is a little bit ironic considering I spent 6 years of my life rowing, trying to learn to use my legs, and then I came back again and I had to stop there. But so it's definitely something we've got to start thinking about and being involved in those discussions about how will you package that into a boat and how you get to work with all the systems that are on board. And it's definitely an area where, with the crew numbers coming down, there's a lot more power to be had there from less people. So I'm sure we'll see quite a few teams going down that route. Obviously there's been a lot more going on behind the scenes with the new resource that we have from Mercedes and the design side of it. So that's been, something that I've kind of not got fully stuck into yet, but the training side of it is always ongoing. And I mean, I love to train and keep fit anyway, so it's not too much of a hassle.
So are you doing that as part of the team now, or will you do that as an individual and then kind of come together for training camps?
Not really entirely sure how it works. I mean, there's a few of us who have signed up. We stay in close contact and try and get together where we can. But I'm sure there'll be times when we'll have some training bases and people will be based more full-time then and get some more done. But the luxury of the equipment and stuff that's around these days, training on your own isn't that bad. You can connect very quickly with some other people in the virtual world of cycling. And then now the weather's starting to get a bit better, hopefully, it looks like it, get back out on the road, because it hasn't been particularly nice over the winter.
I'm not going to ask you how much it costs, but I'm guessing there's a very expensive road bike somewhere in your vicinity.
I think I've got a couple more. I've got an old one that I used to use. But I think I've got the static bike that sits in my garage, which gets more use.
So, oh, really? Because that's better for the training.
Not quite that exciting, unfortunately. Maybe we can kind of have a chat to the Ineos Grenadiers and see if they'll give us a few of their spare bikes knocking around.
Yeah, well, it's beginning to look like a great tie-up, isn't it, with all of that expertise with the cycling?
I think it's a very different-looking cup team, really. I think a lot of the teams as well now, there's so much more resource available, other areas, other sports tying in with their knowledge and experience that hopefully you can draw upon to bring out the best out of our team, really. And yeah, with Mercedes, with the cycling background as well, we've hopefully put ourselves in a good position, whereas... as everyone knows, we've got a big challenge ahead to try and bring the cup back. And it's one that I don't think we'll stop at until we get it done.
Well, it's been fascinating to hear of your amazing transition through these sports in your career. Thanks for sharing that with us. I'm sure the listeners will have enjoyed it. Hopefully we'll be able to check in with you again at some point during the campaign and find out whether you're cycling or whether you're grinding.
Well, off to San Francisco for the next LGP event coming up soon. So that'd be good to get back out on the water and get racing again. And well, like with Ben and Neil as well, we've got another grinder out there. So it's always a good opportunity to get some more racing in and launch a new brand for the SailGP team as well. So it'd be all very exciting for us. And hopefully we can keep that rolling alongside the cup stuff over the next few years. And yeah, that's the biggest thing, get some more racing done and try and hit the ground running when it comes to the next cup.
Well, I'll be in San Francisco too. I'd like to say I'll see you in the gym, but I won't. But hopefully I'll see you on the water. And but for now, Matt, thank you so much for taking the time today.
No problem. Thank you very much.
Well, that's it for this episode of the Yacht Racing Podcast. My thanks to Matt Gottrell for taking the time out of his day to speak to me. And thanks also to all of you for listening around the world. I'll be back soon with another great interview. And until then, I'll just say as usual, sail fast, everyone.